You're listening to KGNU. Welcome to the all-new hour-long show, Fair Play. We're going to take a deep, one-step-closer look into the sports and topics of today. I'm your host, Jimmy Searfoss. You may have heard me before if you listen on Fridays. I host the weekly sports talk segments, and those cover local news from across the Front Range. And I'm joined here today with a professor at the University of Colorado, Garrett Bredsen, who teaches one of my favorite classes that I've taken this year, sports philosophy. He also teaches philosophy. How are you today, Professor?
I'm great, Jimmy. Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yes, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? How did you get into sports philosophy? What is sports philosophy?
Yeah, I'm from Wisconsin. And, you know, in Wisconsin, sports is definitely something that you grow up with, the Packers and the Badgers and the Bucks and the Brewers and all that stuff. Originally, my interest in sports, my interest in philosophy were totally distinct. In philosophy, I work mostly on, you know, obscure topics in the history of German philosophy, not very sports-like. We've been teaching this class, and I'll give a shout-out to my old colleague, Alex Wolfrud, who helped develop it originally. We developed this class about 5 years ago, and we've been offering it. And I kind of jumped at the opportunity to start teaching it myself. And it's been really fun, actually, to get my interest in just rational argument and philosophy together with my interest in sports, which is longstanding and has permeated my whole life together. So, yeah, and my background is not in sports philosophy, but I've been teaching it for about 5 years, and it has been probably the most fun class that I've taught, and I've learned a lot along the way as well.
For sure. One of my favorite parts of that class was all the athletes that would take the class.
Right.
I remember you passing out assignments and you were just going, Jarek Broussard, who was the running back at the time for CU. I turned my head pretty fast, you know, just to see the guy was sitting right behind me. We're still waiting on John Lindorf, who's going to co-host with us. He's going to hop on the Zoom call today. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it in. But I wanted to get the ball rolling a little bit early. Let's get our sports minds right. So I wanted to talk about what our original interest in sports was. Where did that come from? So you want to let us know, Professor?
Yeah, it's a great question because I was thinking about this. You know, I there's not one moment I can point to in my life where it was like, oh, you know, now sports means something to me that it didn't before. I mean, it from as long as I can remember, I mean, that's how we would spend, you know, Saturday, Sunday mornings, read the sports page. Of course, you know, now we get our sports news a little bit differently, but it's... Yeah, to this day, I'll sit down with my breakfast, open up The Athletic or something like that, and read the sports page again. I mean, of course, I can think of all kind of like formative moments early in my life, the 1989 Green Bay Packers season and things like that. But even before that, I mean, sports was kind of that was the thing I was most interested in as a kid, both playing and just following it as, you know, like I didn't care about the news, but I cared about the sports page.
Yeah, I was kind of the same way. I could actually pinpoint it to one season where I start being aware of the sports around me, and it's the 2011 Texas Rangers season, because they had just gone to the World Series, and they went again, and I actually got the opportunity to go to a World Series game. My dad took me. It was a whole experience, and I still remember it, and it was a lot of fun. And I remember playing baseball and being number one, and it was really just the smallest number they had, because, you know, I'm not a huge guy, but I would be like, oh, it's because I'm Elvis Andrews, and that's why.
Right. Yeah, no, for me, the distinct memory I can have of, you know, being at a game, if you follow NFL, you might still remember the Packers-Seahawks game where Matt Hasselbeck says in overtime, you know, we want the ball, we're going to score, and Al Harris intercepts a pass, returns it for a touchdown. That was right into the end zone. I was sitting, you know, probably six rows up from that. Not a great seat, but it was great when Al Harris is running at you and you realize the Seahawks have gone down. But, you know, and of course, we all have these moments in our lives that kind of crystallize things. Yeah.
So it looks like John Lindorf has joined us today. That's my co-host on this show. You guys know John Lindorf if you're listening to KGNU. He hosts Radio Nibbles and is a golf and food writer for Colorado Avid Magazine. How are you today, John?
Just doing great, Jim. And I think most people know me for food and pie, and I've been doing that for 40 years, but secretly I've been a sports fan all my life. I've been paying attention to it since I went to a Red Sox game at the Fenway Park many years ago, and saw Jim Lonborg pitch and Carl Yastrzemski hit a home run. And I secretly have been watching all along since I've moved to Colorado many years ago. I stopped being a Patriots and a Red Sox fan, and my allegiances have all switched to Colorado. And when you mentioned your interest in sports, I said, you gotta do a sports show. And I love the idea of talking about sports ethics. And because there's so many issues now that really are top of mind, what do you think is most important to start with?
Well, I think we could hop into our topic for today. So what we want to cover today is college recruiting. For those who are unaware, high school athletes will often get recruited or will do recruiting themselves to get into college athletics. I wanted to keep in mind that these kids are 15 to 18 years old. So coaches can start pursuing these athletes at 15 years old, just after their sophomore year. Some people are still a little younger. When people think of college recruiting, they often will hear these massive stories of these big spending colleges after these high school athletes, when that often for most is not the case. That's for our big time athletes, big football, big basketball guys. A lot of times people have to do the kind of the recruiting themselves. They're going out and talking to coaches and things like that. And a lot of an easier way to do this is through these sites, these companies and businesses that are built around college athletics, where the kid is the product and you pay a certain amount of money and they will upload videos and put you into contact with coaches like that. But only 7% of high school athletes get to really play in college, and even less get a scholarship to do it. A lot of these kids that are using sites like these are not going to these big D1 schools. If they're going to a big D1 school, they wouldn't really need the site. So do you feel like this is an exploitative site that is causing money or people are paying to use that may or work out for an athlete or may not?
Well, Jimmy, I mean, it's a great question. I think this is like a very difficult one. Anytime that you're basically selling a dream, which is what this is, some people's dreams come true, and it's hard to say that it wasn't worth it for them. As you know, for the vast majority of people, that's not the case. Even if you know that as a 15 to 18 year old, I mean, you might be able to recite that same statistic that you just gave me, right? I could have done that when I was 16. Luckily, I was not nearly talented enough to be recruited by anyone. You know, I had the, arm strength of a dead chicken and the foot speed of a hot dog vendor. But, you know, a lot of my friends were in this situation. And it's tough. Look, you're not really in a position to make those sorts of life-changing decisions, but you have to make a lot of them, frankly, when you're 15 to 18, no matter whether you're being recruited for athletics, whether you're choosing a college, whether you're choosing a major, all kinds of things, right, which will impact you for the rest of your life. So I don't have a magic solution to it in the sense of like, well, you know, we ought not to do this until people are a certain age. I don't know where you draw that line exactly, but man, I mean, I teach first-term freshmen in college, and half the time I feel like they too, it's like, I don't know if you're ready to be recruited and you're already at college here. So I don't know. To me, it's a really tough question to answer. I think it raises a lot of ethical issues, but I don't think there's going to be many clean solutions to it either.
John, did you have something to say?
Yeah, I mean, I went through this because my son was a college athlete in football and sports in a D3 school. And just to see the amount of paperwork and, it was like a second full-time job. It so often leads to disappointment and expense. And you have your life geared in one way, and it doesn't go that way. We also wanted to say that we welcome anyone listening in the audience to call in. If you we'd love to talk to somebody who has been a recruited athlete or who has run into some of these problems. What's that number?
That number is going to be 303-442-4242.
And I'm going to take that as a cue, even though I'm not listening online. I am operating the board, but I have questions of my own. When did this whole industry pop up? I didn't remember it when I was in high school, but I was approached about it with my daughter now ready to go into college.
I couldn't tell you an exact number, really. I'm not entirely sure. I do know that... recently with the surge of the internet and things like that, it definitely has grown in popularity to go this way. I mean, we're not sending mail anymore, you know?
Right.
So email, you know, social media, the rise of social media has been massive in recruiting. You can go up and DM a coach now, you know? People are so accessible these days. You can basically have an entire recruiting profile on Twitter strictly.
Yeah. And, you know, back in the 90s, it was people sending mail, physical mail back and forth to each other. That's how you got recruited, whether you're an athlete or whether you're a student. I mean, that's what was going on. Now with social media, I mean, you know, in both directions, you have a ton of content being generated both by recruits and by the recruiters that, you know, in some ways, it's a much more interesting way of recruiting. It is extremely time intensive. And of course, it's expensive. I mean, it is true. These products that are being sold to students, even if they're exploitative, sometimes they're very expensive to make. It's very labor intensive.
And I know even to just get recruited by NCAA, you have to create a profile, which does cost money in itself. It's a money step from day one.
It's not cheap either. I mean, it's I wanted to just add my own personal experience of this as a parent. You know, they will call you and they will set up a time to talk to you and they will give you a very, very hard sell. And it's kind of like, well, you know, I can't really afford that four-figure number you're citing to me, because, you know, they'll try to throw in bells and whistles like, oh, well, do you have videos of your kid playing sports? How about some professional shots of them in action? And, you know, if you're not prepared for it, you're just like, no, I don't know. Well, don't you want your kid to go to college? Don't you want him to get some scholarships? You know, look, I know these coaches and these coaches and these coaches, and I know that they're looking for somebody with your daughter's profile, you know, and it's a very, very, as you were saying, selling a dream, but also selling the possibility of educational attainment that might be out of reach for a lot of lower income families. And even if you say something like, well, I can't really afford it, they're like, well, are you on free and reduced lunch? Yeah, well, we'll lower the price by 50%. I'd really rather like hold on to that money, right? Very, very insistent, sending text messages because they need the cell phone numbers of the parents. And they really, I would put it on par with what, you know, you sometimes hear about military recruiters. So, you know, I myself was stunned. Again, if anybody has had personal experience with this arguably unethical recruiting tactic, give us a call, 303-442-4242. And I see John raising his hand. Jump in.
I think we would be, I mean, you mentioned that your daughter was recruited, and I think it has changed. I think more women are being recruited. Boulder, you know, Boulder High and Fairview are a little bit different than some schools because they generate so many incredibly talented women athletes. But I think the professor could probably speak to the gross difference between how women and men are recruited for college sports.
Oh, sure. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the recruiting for the sports that are really the headline sports at universities, it can be a very different game. I mean, the stakes are extremely high for the universities. You know, how your football team is doing, frankly, it's something that everyone in town knows at any given time. You go around Boulder, people know, right, how things are going. It's a lot of pressure, and these are also, you know, sports that generate a lot of the revenue that are ultimately going to pay for the other sports as well. It means that the stakes in recruiting are very different. Sometimes that's beneficial to recruits, like you get lavished with things, but it also means that the pitches are even harder, right? And the pitches are even more aggressive. And of course, the students who play the sports that tend to generate the most revenue also tend to be the ones who come from the lowest socioeconomic backgrounds. So, I mean, yeah, it cuts both ways, but I would say, yeah, the recruiting experience is systematically different.
So coaches can start reaching out to kids as young as right after their sophomore year of high school. That's when the NCAA allows people to start reaching out and having conversations. But before that, they can get pamphlets and things like that. Is that too young? Do you feel like that's too young to be starting getting pursued by coaches, John?
I do. I was the father of a particularly mature 15-year-old. And luckily, he ended up in deep statistics and successfully employed. But he put together I was 16 years old, and he put together this spreadsheet of D3 colleges, and he, starting with what he wanted academically, and working down, you know, was he going to get to play? He knew he wasn't going to play at D1. And I think for some parents and students, athletes, they need to narrow their target, you know, that pick the right place. It's, you know, most people aren't going to play at Alabama or Ohio State.
Yeah, and I'll just add too, I mean, I completely agree with you, John. I think it's too young. For the few students who do have these monetizable skills and who know it early, one of the challenges is that, you know, oftentimes it's very clear by, you know, by 15 and sometimes well before that. I mean, you know, Jim, I'm sure we've all heard stories of people being recruited unofficially at very young ages. And of course, if you raise the age at which, for example, you can contact recruits. Part of the other problem is that money's going to find a way. Interest in recruiting is still going to find a way to kids with monetizable skills off the books. So for those few students who do have these monetizable skills, especially in football and in basketball, there, I don't know what to say. In some ways, the longer you put off when official contact is allowed, sometimes just the more you incentivize things going on behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah.
So I have a question about that as well. So I see at games that there are a lot of people with professional video gear and with photos, and I just kind of assumed that those are the people that were contracted by these recruiting services to make, you know, videos and whatnot. Is it reasonable to believe that they may also be kind of just checking out the field for underage recruits?
A lot of times, actually, in the case of that, people will make their own highlight videos, and people will actually, it's very popular nowadays for high school players to have someone create their own highlight videos, because those are really big, especially in the college world. A lot of people, I knew a guy in high school who was super into making highlight tapes for our football team, and now he does it at Texas A&M. It's just a massive industry. Sports media has exploded, and you got to get on it early. You got to develop those skills early. So a lot of times that would be the case for people with these fancy cameras and such on the sidelines of high school games and things like that. But college athletic recruitment is a multi-million dollar business. Georgia, I saw back in 2019, spent over $3 million on football alone. So should colleges be allocating such kind of money towards the athletic programs, which often outside of football and basketball cause a net loss in profits for the university? I mean, isn't the point of university education over athletics?
Well, Jimmy, there's a lot to say here. And there's a fundamental tension, of course, that is hard to resolve. On the one hand, at Georgia, their football team, of course, generates tons of revenue. I mean, it's a truly shocking amounts, enough to fund the rest of their athletic program. Mm-hmm. In that sense, of course, you might think it's very well justified to, you know, spend the kind of money which allows their football program to be so lucrative, which then supports the rest of the programs. On the other hand, that introduces a kind of inequity, right? If you're recruiting football players with $3 million, they can't use that kind of budget to recruit every single athletic varsity team that they have. Well, how do you trade off between those things? Because on the one hand, the football team is subsidizing the rest of the university sports teams. But on the other hand, as a university, I mean, not only is it ethical, but it's actually a legal requirement to treat people equally, regardless of gender. And I think philosophical questions. It's not easy to know how to answer them in theory or to balance them in practice. And I don't envy the athletic directors who actually do have to, you know, make these decisions a lot of times.
I like to look at it as college is a place for people to develop as a young adult into the culture of today, whether that be developed for a job. And a part of that is sports. Sports is a part of culture. It's a, you know, we go outside and we wait on Sundays. Everyone gets together on Sundays to watch football. You know, we make these massive stadiums. So of course it should be a part of college and education growing up and going through that system. John, do you have anything to say?
I don't see how you avoid that, because we love sports. You know, it's been part of culture since ancient Greece. You know, they keep uncovering these ancient civilizations, and what do they have in common? besides the fact that they made something like pie, you know. It was sports. It was competition. And I think that competition is fundamental. But the, you know, I think part there's two things. One is I think that we might as well go ahead and admit the college teams are, it's the minor leagues for the National Football League, okay? They could have done it differently, but they didn't. The other thing is that now college students can be compensated while they're in college. And they're starting to get paid for the use of their images, which is great, but, you know, you can see the problems there.
Yeah, and we will get into that a little on later into the show. But I wanted to talk a little bit about that budget for college recruitment, specifically for Colorado. In 2020, Yahoo reported that Colorado's athletic budget was nearly $150 million. $1.5 million. Sorry. That's a lot of money. I was unable to find the football portion of that on that Yahoo page. But in 2019, the Denver Post reported the football budget was $775,312. And that was just going to the football team. Is that fair to other sports, especially sports like women's athletics?
No. I mean, you know, Jimmy, I think it's, again, a great question. It goes back to this fundamental divide. The model at these big Power Five schools is that football makes the money and the rest of the athletic varsity sports spend the money. I mean, that's the fundamental model that big Power Five schools are built on. It's different if you look at Division III schools, Division II schools, and some lower tier Division I schools. But that's the model at schools like CU Boulder and other schools in the Pac-12. So what is fair here? Like, normally we think fairness just means equality, but again, in this case, obviously part of the investment in football is designed specifically to support the other sports. Does the fact that football players through their, I'll just call it labor, football players through their labor are supporting the other sports, does that entitle them to benefits that don't accrue to other sports? Or does the fact that, you know, we have a duty to treat all our athletes equally with equal respect, does that mean that they're not entitled to anything extra there? Again, it's a difficult, again, both conceptual and practical question, I think.
John?
Go ahead with the next point.
All right.
Actually, I'm going to jump in real quick and give a station ID. You are listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. And if you'd like to join in the conversation, the number is 303-442-4242.
So what happens during a college football big-time recruiting pitch? So oftentimes these kids will be flown out to whatever university or taken there in some fancy mode of transportation. Their lodging will be paid for. They'll be getting nice clothes, photo shoots, fancy meals, all in like a super nice hotel. The University of Texas reportedly just spent $280,000 on a single recruiting trip for one kid, Archie Manning, who might sound a little familiar to the Colorado fans around here. That is Peyton Manning's nephew. That's a lot of money, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, it's mind-boggling. What's it, $280,000? You know, he's a Manning.
Yeah, that's over most people's salary. That's like a couple few people's saying. That's like maybe
multiple years of people's salaries, yeah.
Yeah, you know, talk to me in a decade, I'll make that much, yeah.
That's just one trip.
Yeah.
And also, you know, realistically, in the past, other things have been used to entice young men to to go to a particular college. You know, whether it was alcohol or engagement with the opposite sex, or, you know, any number of things which were really on the edge of legality.
In 2019, the National College Players Association came out with a study announcing that 86% of college athletes live below the federal poverty line. On a recruiting trip where they're getting pampered and flown out and treated with these luxuries, is that a little bit manipulative to athletes that aren't living a life like that? Especially, because they don't know what their life is going to be like at this university. Especially, it's a foreign place a lot of times, especially these big D1 schools. John, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that that's the reality for the majority of college athletes, especially if they don't come from middle or upper class families. You know, there is a there's a food bank at CU in the UMC. It's quite busy. I've talked to the folks there, and you know, I mean, it's there's a lot of students that are just getting by because they aren't starters or they aren't in football, and you know, they could end up getting injured, you know, which we should also talk about, is that there's sometimes there's life, there's problems that last the rest of your life because you play football or soccer, you know. I'd like to ban heading, for instance, you know, because that seems like a really bad idea.
Yeah. Jimmy, if I can pop in too, I mean, on these recruiting visits, I mean, there's a deep irony, right? You know, pampered and luxury and, you know, things are flashy. And then, of course, you get here and, yeah, and the statistics don't lie, right? I mean, it's a meager existence that you're eking out, frankly. But it's an irony, but of course, it's not a coincidence either. And there are reasons for this. It's incredibly valuable for these universities to recruit these top athletes, but they can't pay them to come here. Yeah. The one thing that would keep them above the poverty line is the one thing, of course, that is most clearly prohibited by NCAA rules for colleges to do. So they're going to spend this money somewhere. They're going to make the recruiting visit as lavish as they possibly can, precisely because they don't have a more efficient way to spend that money in actually, you know, enticing kids directly.
Well, and also, you know, I'd like to inject a little note of reality here in Colorado. The CU Buffs are just a horrible football team. They are an abject failure this year. If you divide the amount of money they are spending into their amount of wins and touchdowns, same thing with CSU. I mean, you got to wonder, you know, what's it all for?
Oh, for sure. We've all been wondering that heavily.
Yeah.
One of the biggest parts of these recruiting trips is the facilities. At this recent CU game, I was working with the sports department, and I saw on the field we had a ton of recruits at that game with UCLA, and you know that they had just seen the facilities that that they used to work out in, the football team, and then Folsom Field in itself. One of the things that really stuck with me from the last year's class when I took this sports philosophy class, when we were talking about this similar topic, you talked about college facilities at times can be more lavish and better than professional facilities. Can you get into that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely true. And I would encourage, you know, if anyone has, you know, time to kill later today, just start Googling some of these college football locker rooms, especially in the SEC. Yeah. It's actually kind of amazing. I mean, I want to hang out in Alabama's locker room. And I don't know, locker rooms, you know, when I grew up playing sports, like, it wasn't places you would want to spend much time, frankly. You want to get in there and get out of there as quickly as you can. Not so much the case at some of them. But again, you know, it's the same kind of dynamic that we see playing out, interestingly, I think, right? So Alabama, they've got all this money from boosters. They can't give it directly to players, but they can build a waterfall in the locker room. They can put all these hot tubs in there. If I'm a professional team, right? If I'm a baseball team, I've got, you know, oh, man, I've got $10 million. How can I best spend that to recruit free agents to my team? Just offer them the money, right? I mean, yeah. It's a pretty straightforward proposition. But imagine that you're a baseball team and it's like, well, you've got $10 million, but the one thing you can't do is give any of that money to free agents. How do you then induce free agents to go there? Well, you would see them building locker rooms that are pretty nice in a hurry as well. It's not as efficient a use of funds, of course, but if that's what the rules require, then it's going to end up somewhere. So I think you see, interestingly, a similar kind of thing playing out with the recruiting visits being very lavish, and then the reality that students step into looks very different from that. But, you know, these college football locker rooms are really symptoms, I think, of this deep disconnect between the value of the services that these players are providing to the university and what the NCAA rules allow universities to provide back in turn to players.
John, you have anything to chime in?
Well, I think it'd be interesting to look at the difference between the athletic facilities available to the average student at CU and what's available to the top-flight athletes at CU.
I completely agree. I know, you know, I've been to the rec center quite a few times. It's a nice place, but it's not, you know, the strength and conditioning.
It's not Dal Ward, yeah.
Yeah, it's not Dal Ward, and the locker rooms sure aren't as nice. I would wonder the difference between the men's and women's locker rooms, mm-hmm. especially in these athletic sports. I know they're probably still nice, but I wonder if they are as nice as the, you know, the football and basketball team.
Yeah,
well,
maybe
there's someone out there listening that could let us know about that.
Yeah, in general, I mean, look, I don't hang out in women's locker rooms. Let's make that clear. It's not a direct experience. But my general sense from students that I've talked to, you know, at many places, not just here, is that, yeah, I think unsurprisingly, there's a systematic difference. And again, that seems like the kind of thing that should be impermissible at a school receiving public funds.
Recently, I did take a look into a few of those videos. Colorado has a really good one out, and it looks nice and things like that, and then you look at a school like Alabama and you realize, wow, this is big time money. They got chairs that are like zero gravity, you know, they have their faces right next to them in their lockers, phone chargers, video games. I know, heck, even Colorado, I'm pretty sure, has a barbershop seat in it. They'll hire a barber to come in at time to cut the player's hair, which is making me a little jealous.
Yeah, right. You know, I don't have much hair, so it's, you know, for me, it's like, wait, haircuts? Oh yeah, I remember those things back when I was a younger man. Yeah, but I, again, here, right, like, you know, having a barber come in, of course, that's a nice, you know, thing to mention to recruits, you know, and to show, you know, there. But man, if I was a recruit, I would prefer an extra $100 in my pocket than having the possibility of getting a haircut in the locker room. Again, that's the one thing, of course, that you can't offer a recruit.
So, Professor, what are there three or four things where, you know, at the top of your list that you consider the most unethical recruiting practices?
Oh, man. No, thanks, John. No, that's a hard one. Jimmy, actually, I mean, I think in some ways, you know, you might be better able to speak to specifics, because I can kind of look at things from a 30,000 foot view, but I was certainly never recruited as a college athlete. And, you know, my experiences are all indirect and they're very anecdotal, right? I mean, what some students will tell me here or there, anyone can stumble in, of course, to a situation where they have unethical recruiting practices. And I think the real interesting question is, like, what systematically is unethical? Yeah. And to me, I do think, like, this disconnect between the reality of being a college athlete and what you see on a recruiting visit. Again, I understand the reasons for it, and I think that given the way the rules are set up, that's how it's going to be. Saying it's unethical won't do anything to make it less so, but I do think it is unethical. I do think that there's a I do think that this kind of selling, it all just encourages this kind of selling a dream kind of mentality that we've been talking about. So maybe I'll just start there. And I think that thing that we've talked about is a great example.
Yep. Right before we get back into that, I wanted to re-identify us. I'm Jimmy Searfoss. I'm here with my co-host, John Lindorf, and University of Colorado professor, Garrett Bredesen. And I would figure most unethical, I would make it seem like a lot of these college recruiting sites make it seem like this is your only way to get into higher education.
Yeah.
And you kind of touched on it earlier about the difference between what you see in a college athlete and what a college student athlete is really like. Because in reality, that's what it is, a student athlete. And it's tough even at the D1 level. These guys are getting, you know, pampered and things like that. They have the nicest facilities. But especially even at these lower levels, D1 or D2 schools, NIA schools, D3 schools, you don't have those kind of facilities, and you're kind of just going through it, especially with classes and things like that.
Yeah. Well, and let me just pick up on that last point about classes, because that's the other thing that I think, you know, deserves mention here. You know, a lot of this is, right, you know, what you mentioned, okay, this is the path into higher education, right, for your son or your daughter. Okay, maybe, but what is that higher education going to look like when they get there? There's a Pac-12 study that came out about a decade ago. It's actually sponsored by the Pac-12, and it showed that according to Pac-12 athletes, they average about 50 hours a week in season. Now, that's far more than, you know, you can legally require, I should say by NCAA rules, require people to practice. But it's clear that by the amount of time that athletes are putting in, they're athletes first and students second, certainly in season and maybe even out of season. Being able to take advantage of a top flight education is not as easy as just being enrolled at a school. You actually have to be able to put in the time in your classes. And that is something which, unfortunately, and the athletes themselves will often be the first to tell you, like, that doesn't feel realistic to them in season. That's tough. That's another disconnect, right, between, I think, what you're sold, hey, world-class education, and then what you get, which is, in some ways, of course, you're in the same class as everybody else, you have the same access, but do you have enough time? That is the one key thing that every college student knows that they need to succeed.
Oh, we know.
And it is tough.
Yes. So, before we get into our next topic, I have a task. Can you do your best to explain what NIL is for the listeners out there?
Sure. Name, image, and likeness. So since summer of 2021, it has now been allowed by NCAA rules for players to profit off their name, image, and likeness as it relates to their identity as a student athlete. I think a lot of people, especially outside of sports, saw that as a relatively small change. You know, there were these stories before of, you know, someone would put up a YouTube channel of him doing some cool trick kick, and then the NCAA would, you know, come down on him because, well, you know, now he's profiting off the fact that he's a football player. And that seemed very silly. In lifting that rule, however, I mean, it's been a real sea change, and we're in the midst of it. Right? Where this is going to go, we don't know yet. But we're in a real sea change with college recruiting across many sports, and especially in football, the most heavily monetizable one. And the other, again, everything is changing so quickly right now with NIL. The one thing I'll just mention, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about it more, is these NIL collectives that are popping up at different schools that are run by boosters and alumni that will hook up athletes with abilities to connect with other people selling name, image, and likeness.
We do have a caller, but we don't have a call screener. So, caller, I don't know your name, but when you get the prompt, you are on the air. Good morning.
Good morning.
What's your question, caller?
So I'm going to remain a little bit anonymous, but I'm a Division II coach in the area.
Very nice. What's the question?
And I'm just going to make a couple comments. We could talk for hours about recruiting and facilities and stuff like that. So first point would be that recruiting is not an exact science from either side, from the athlete's side or the coach's side, for sure. But I would say in terms of the recruiting services that me personally, I don't know that it's really worth the money. If the coaches are really doing their homework, they will find you, whether you're a Division I, Division II, Division III, NAIA, junior college. You know, they will find you as an athlete. So, and that said, we actually do have a freshman that on our team this year that we did find through a service. So, but in general, for the money spent, again, that may be just a personal family decision to go that route. But as a Division II coach, we like to think that we do our homework and we're gonna find the athletes that we want, regardless of services or not. So, and then in terms of facilities, being a smaller Division II school, you know, we're gonna put up some red flags if we have a recruit on campus and they start talking about the amenities or facilities in some negative way. We want them to be there to play the sport, to get a good education, and, you know, if there's something else that they're looking for in terms of those amenities and niceties, we may not be as high. They may not be as high on our list, let's put it that way. So, and then, you know, in general, our job is help these athletes become adults. You know, we're in the business of providing a pathway to adulting, and so academics come over athletics at any point in our recruiting, for sure. So those are the points I'd like to make.
Thank you very much for that call. And I think he did bring up a very good point in the beginning there. We can go through them. But there is a bit of that saying, especially in the NFL, you know, if you can play, they'll find you.
Yeah.
And that is even another point that, you know, some of these recruitment sites, you know, may lead you to believe that is not the case as much. They'll find you if you got the talent.
And you know, recruiting does look so different, right, at these different levels of collegiate play, both in terms of what colleges are looking for and the kind of experience, right, that athletes are looking for there as well. So, yeah, I mean, it runs the gamut from whether you're, you know, Division III, Division II, Division I as to what this experience is going to look like on both ends of the recruiting side.
And I do feel like the smaller you go when it comes to college-wise, maybe you are getting a different look when it comes to athletic-wise and education-wise, because maybe athletics do not make you that much money as a school. So you have that bigger focus on education. A lot of these, not necessarily maybe D2 school, but a lot of these smaller schools like a D3 or a JUCO are built to get people to that D1 level. So they have to have the education. And in Colorado, even as a transfer policy, you have to have a certain amount of credits. You have to have a certain amount of progress in your degree before you can transfer over here, which was kind of an issue this last offseason because so many players did transfer out of Colorado football. They were trying to get people in, but a lot of them didn't have the requirements met for education on the educational side of things.
Yeah, and another thing I'll point out too is that at these, you know, the way that athletics is integrated into the university as a whole and the way it fulfills the university's mission, I think, whether intentionally or not, has come to look quite different at, for example, Division III schools and Division I schools. At a school like CU Boulder, the athletic department can be relatively or, you know, pretty close to financially self-sustaining, and they have a lot of autonomy. It can make it feel like it's kind of a separate entity from the rest of the university. Whereas at a Division III school, I mean, the athletic program is never going to make money. It's going to be a cost to the university. Precisely for that reason, though, it's oftentimes more answerable to the institutional norms and the institutional goals of the university as a whole. So if you're at a Division III school, like where, a small school where I went to college, it can feel oftentimes like athletics is better integrated into campus life than at a Division I school, where athletics kind of feels like it's this big thing going on next to campus.
John?
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about graduation rates for student athletes?
Yeah.
I certainly don't have any like recent specific figures. Graduation rates for student athletes as a whole, and this is true at CU Boulder, and it's true pretty much universally in the NCAA, are quite high. They're typically higher than they are for other students who are enrolled. But there's big differences depending on what sport you're looking at, right? And here, again, unsurprisingly, the sports that recruit most heavily from students from disadvantaged socioeconomic backgrounds are typically going to have lower graduation rates. The students who oftentimes are most sold that, hey, this is the way to a real education, they will be the ones typically less likely to graduate in an athletic department. The NCAA has actually done quite a bit of work to try to incentivize graduation rates, but it's, again, one thing to achieve that across an athletic department as a whole. It's another thing to achieve that in specific sports, especially football and men's basketball, that traditionally have had lower graduation rates, not just because people are going pro too early, that's a very small percentage of students, but again, oftentimes because they aren't making enough progress towards their degree while they're in school.
And one of my favorite topics from the class that we had was talking about a lot. What are these student athletes studying? And a lot of times they are like communications degrees, typically what would be seen as maybe an easier degree. But, you know, they're not getting that same level of education often wise. And one of my favorite, this is a deep rabbit hole, but it was talking about like having athletic major. That was one of the topics that really intrigued me last year, because if you think about it, you know, you made the comparison to music. A lot of times, you know, people would major in music when they often have the same success rate out of college. You know, not there's not a lot of money in that music industry. It's just a fun thing to talk about,
yeah.
Comparing athletics to music.
And I'm a big believer, really, that and John, this actually goes to one of the points that you made earlier in the show. I'm a big believer that college athletics can and should be integrated into the rest of the university curriculum. The kinds of skills that are taught to our college athletes, the kinds of things that they gain through practice and performance, are not as different as the kinds of skills, for example, that our music majors gain through practice and performance, as is often imagined. I think there's a kind of social stigma against sports that it's low culture, whereas like music is high culture. I think there's a real prejudice there that has kind of infected the way that we think about these things. But I'm exactly what this would look like, I don't know, but I'm a huge supporter of anything that tries to see common principles between athletic performance and academic education more broadly.
I wanted to cover a few more things before we run out of time here. So, like we said, these kids are now getting paid. The schools cannot pay them directly, even though we know a few times there have been scandals. Hopefully we get to that. So, the way these schools are getting money to these athletes a lot of times, like we said, is through boosters and through outside businesses. They'll set up communication lines between them. Do we think that really almost takes away from the college football or college sports experience, and that it might turn more into a money issue for a lot of these kids that live in that 86% rather than where do I feel like I can be the most successful?
Well, I think that's definitely the direction. I mean, for better or for worse, that's the direction that we're going in terms of big-time college sports right now. Money is it's still against the NCAA rules to provide any kind of pay-for-play arrangement. And even if you're an independent name, image, and likeness collective that is hooking up students with opportunities, it's also against NCAA rules for you to make any contract that the student enters into contingent upon their continued athletic participation at that university. However, that all being said, everyone knows, and if you paid attention this summer, I mean, this is kind of what the Nick Saban Jimbo Fisher spat was about. Everyone knows that there's something else in the big picture going on here with NIL collectives. Even if it's not written specifically into the contracts that students are signing with outside firms that their money is contingent on attendance at a university, oftentimes that's understood. And so what ends up happening is that you often have, I want to be careful with what words I use. I want to say that NIL has almost become a semi-money laundering scheme that is used to get around many NCAA rules. But of course, yeah, then the question is, like, does this affect and how does this affect the integrity of college sports? Well, on the one hand, you could say, you know, maybe the fact that athletes have more direct access to the kinds of compensation that is commensurate with the value that they're producing for universities, maybe that enhances the integrity of college sports. But on the other hand, given that we're in the wild, wild west of this, it's still the case that not everyone is necessarily playing by the same set of rules. And when you have a set of rules and it's not clear that everyone is playing by them, that is an integrity issue there.
Where do you think this all goes if you were going to project out 10 years? Where do you think we'll be at?
Yeah, I mean, the big question here is what's going to happen legally. The Supreme Court decision in NCAA v. Alston, which basically laid down the gauntlet, especially in the really explosive concurrence that Justice Kavanaugh wrote, that has set up the legal landscape that there's going to be a lot of development. And at some point here, we're going to get an answer to this question. Can the NCAA legally prohibit pay for play? That is what this is all going to come down to. Right now, the answer is it's not clear. Kavanaugh has basically invited future litigation on that. It's already working its way up. Eventually, I bet this will come back to the Supreme Court. I think we will have an answer on that. I don't know what that answer will be, but I think the next 5 years is going to be characterized by uncertainty about that, and that is going to really kneecap the NCAA in trying to enforce the rules they have on the books because they may not even be legal. So they don't want to invite, you know, even further litigation. It's a messy situation, but an interesting time for college sports.
We do have a caller. Lynn, you are on the air.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, how does football make the world a better place? And I wanted to cite one issue in Boulder, locally, that made, in my opinion, the world a much less good place. And that is, there was a lawyer from CU that helped negotiate the deal with CU South and inflated the value by $5 million so the city of Boulder couldn't buy it. As a reward for his work, he was appointed athletic director. He's part owner of Liquor Mart, and later on, Betsy Hoffman cited him for part of the recruitment scandal with the sexual thing going on. So how did this improve the world? You know, I avoid the sports section, and I don't have any interest in sports myself, but in Europe, you know, it's soccer. It's not football. And I just think that the distinction between football and academia is very extreme. And
thank you for your question. Then we want to let the guests have an opportunity to answer before we wrap up. Please go ahead.
Great, thanks. I mean, yeah, there's a huge number of questions that can honestly can be asked about this. And I'll also add the head injury and concussion stuff in football, too, is another huge minefield that we haven't even really been able to wade into today. But I will say that, I mean, you know, if the question is like, you know, are there tangible benefits that one can point to? I'll just mention two things very briefly. I mean, of course, one is I really do believe in the intrinsic educational value of athletics. I think that many Americans do, given the fact that we have our kids spend a lot of their time playing sports. It's an important part of the way that we do educate our students. And I think that's part of what happens. I absolutely believe that football teaches all kinds of not just athletic skills, but teamwork and life skills that are really hard to replicate in other places. And then, look, there is, of course, the financial value to the university, and that is what supports Colorado's athletic department. The football team, the excess revenue that they generate over and above the cost of running the program, that is functionally where the money for running the rest of the varsity teams comes from. That may be too transactional, but it is a real benefit. And if you have any interest in the other teams, you should have some interest in the football team because they're kind of in some way sustaining it.
Well, and I'd say that sometimes, you know, maybe not all of everything that you just listed as a benefit, not perhaps the revenue generating aspect of it, but really pretty much all sports have all of those values that you listed. Jimmy, I'll let you close.
Yeah. So I wanted to get this to this question. So there have been massive scandals throughout college football throughout the years, recruiting scandals, scandals especially, SMU having a most notably the death penalty in the 1970s. That's when they had to pretty much cancel their football program from competing for a while. And that was because they went out and paid players under the table. Teams like Alabama had a similar situation where they paid a student $150,000 to come play with them in the 90s, but they got kind of a slap on the wrist. Do you think, I mean, Alabama's a much bigger school, obviously, and makes a lot more money for the NCAA, for the SEC. Do you think that there is that big of a difference between these big schools and small schools?
In short, the NCAA is now so kneecapped from trying to enforce its own rules because it has basically been put on notice by the Supreme Court that its rules very well may be illegal. That situation puts the NCAA in a very awkward position. It has rules that it wants to enforce to protect the integrity of the game. But on the other hand, the more it tries to enforce them, the more it exposes itself legally, not just in terms of inviting changes to those rules that would be forced by the courts, but potentially, of course, to damages as well for student athletes who have been denied compensation under those rules. So it's not like in the 1980s when the NCAA could throw its full weight against SMU. If it threw its full weight against somebody, it would be the losing party ultimately. And so it needs to tread very carefully. I think that is kind of the background in this legal limbo that we find ourselves in over the next few years, which again, I think is the fundamental feature of the NCAA's reality. That's the situation we need to keep in mind, I think. So I don't expect to see any death penalties coming down from the NCAA anytime soon, unless, you know, they want to cause the death penalty for themselves.
John.
Just to wrap up, I think this has been a remarkable discussion, and something that hasn't often necessarily been heard on KGNU. So I wanted to thank you both for doing this. I think we could do a whole nother show on sports betting its impact on college and professional sports. But this has been great. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. John. This has pretty much been all the time we have for today. This has been Fair Play. I've been your host, Jimmy Searfoss. I've been here with John Lindorf and Professor Garrett Bredesen at the University of Colorado. This has been a great time. I really appreciate everyone for coming out. Thank you guys very much.
Thanks, Jimmy.
And thanks to the listeners and everyone who called in. You are listening to KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Up next is the Morning Sound Alternative with Greg Schultz.
Bob Folk Festival, with support from the Utah Office of Tourism, taking place November 4th to the 6th, and featuring the infamous String Dusters, Peter Rowan, Molly Tuttle, and more. Details at moabfolkfestival.com. Thank you.
I left my home and my one true love east of the Ohio River. Father said we'd never wed, for I had neither gold nor silver.